Well, welcome to another episode of the Nuclear Medicine Molecular Medicine Podcast, the world's longest running medical podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
That's great. And we've got a Canadian colleague here in Denver at the Society of Nuclear Medicine meeting who's won an award. It's the first place in the Young Investigator Award for the Therapy Centre of Excellence. And he talked about something that I think's an absolute booming essential area of medicine and society as a whole. We've got computer-driven cars these days.
For sure.
And that's using AI. I'm going to start by getting you to tell us a bit about yourself, where you're from, where you work, and then talk about what you did.
Sure. So my name is Mark Bryanton. I'm a nuclear medicine physician from Canada. I have an undergraduate degree in biochemistry, and I'm completing my master's in epidemiology right now through the University of Ottawa.
Yep.
I've been working at the Ottawa Hospital for the last 2 years, where I came up with the idea of creating a machine learning algorithm to predict lung cancer recurrence post-radiotherapy. So some of that was fortuitous in that Jason Pantarato, the head of radiation oncology at the Ottawa Hospital, had started creating a data set of about 800 patients whom he had tracked over about 16 years. So it was useful to me in that a lot of outcome data had already been tracked and a lot of clinical data.
Yeah.
And so for me, I just had to acquire the final PET segmentation data. So Hermes Medical Systems was useful for me.
Gotcha.
There.
Yep, yep.
In that Benoit Galarneau, one of the coders through Hermes, was able to make a tidy data output tool as per my specifications. So tidy data is really important for machine learning and creation of algorithmic sorting of data. And so this is something that's been pushed by Hadley Wickham, one of the heroes of R coding. And so to be able to get data exported in a tidy data format like that made it much easier later to incorporate it into my algorithm.
Right. Right. So you already had a gold standard in terms of outcomes.
Correct.
In terms of, so you knew what the outcomes were, and that's essential for developing this kind of machine learning, right?
So it's not essential, but it's essential for testing the accuracy of your
right.
algorithm. So there's supervised machine learning where you know an outcome.
Yep.
And in that case, you can tell the algorithm, create this outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's unsupervised machine learning where the outcome is unknown.
Right.
And in that case, they try to find pure mathematical associations between the data to try to cluster patients into
right.
different groups. So certainly unsupervised machine learning is also big when you can't yet know the outcome.
Right, but you can look at, then you look at the groups they provide, and then
yes.
you want to say, well, what's special about that group, right?
Exactly, and then you, in that case, require content expertise and domain expertise to be able to think, does this grouping make sense? Do I think this likely represents a true patient grouping? Or is this overfitting the model? Because with a lot of the unsupervised machine learning algorithms, you could make the algorithm divide them up into 50 groups or two groups or however many groups you like.
Yeah.
And so eventually you're just creating noise.
Right. And sometimes you end up with correlations with that noise that don't make sense. We've seen a lot of that in fMRI, for example.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's the real joy of supervised machine learning, which is you actually get immediate feedback to say the change, the tuning of the hyperparameters in your algorithm were not successful or were successful, because you can have a gold standard to prove that your accuracy is increasing or decreasing.
Right. So what were the total numbers again of the people that were involved in the study, and did you then test it in a prospective way?
So that's an excellent question. We had about 800 in the total data set with a first lung cancer occurrence.
Yep.
However, only about 550 of them had a PET scan for staging.
Yep.
And then I had several inclusion-exclusion criteria of patients that I thought likely would not represent a predictable outcome,
yep.
such as patients that were lost to follow-up, right?
Right, right.
So my algorithm might predict that they'll have a recurrence, but if we lost them to follow-up
you
after 3 months, exactly, my algorithm might have been right, but we won't be able to prove it or disprove
right.
it.
Right. One of the arguments against that, of course, is those people might be lost to follow-up because they died or whatever.
It's 100% correct, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the lost to follow-up patients were patients who left, so they went back to their original jurisdiction. But you're 100% correct. There's always massive concerns about how to handle lost to follow-up and what's the best way to approach it. In my case, the numbers were quite low in that I really only had to exclude people who are lost to follow-up before the time that my machine learning algorithm was predicting early lung cancer recurrence.
Yes.
So in my case, it was 440 days because that was the trimmed mean progression time for all people who did progress.
Right.
So statistically, it made some sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, yeah.
To select that date, even though from a human interpretation standpoint, it seems like a very arbitrary date.
Yeah.
But because of that, I only had to exclude people who were lost to follow-up.
At that point in time.
Prior to that point in time without a recurrence event. And luckily that number was quite low of 29 patients out of,
right.
So.
Yeah, that's small, yeah.
It's fairly small, yeah.
So in terms of testing how well this worked, in terms of prospectively?
Yes, yeah, your second question. So I'm currently speaking with the head of radiation oncology right now, because certainly the easiest way to test it prospectively would be with a triple blinded study.
Yep.
So basically we would take the predictable outcomes, we would take the predictable features, put it through the machine learning algorithm, predict an outcome, seal that outcome in a digital file of some variety, and then not tell the physicians what the algorithm had predicted, not tell the patients what the algorithm had predicted, and have the statistician completely blinded to what the patient's ultimate outcome was, other than receiving at the very end when the study was released.
Yep.
But in the interim, having no knowledge about what their actual recurrence basically makes it the purest study possible.
Right.
In that you get to test the pure predictive capacity of patients that are 100% naive to the algorithm.
Yeah.
Now the algorithm's already pretty good in that you split the entire retrospective cohort into a testing data set and a training data set.
Okay.
So I've trained the algorithm on one group of patients and then predicted on a separate group of patients.
And how did that turn out?
Turned out well. The accuracy was 86% overall. It ended up being highly specific.
And
that it was very good at identifying patients who would not recur, and it was very good in that the patients who were identified to recur, there was about a 90 to 95% specificity. The weakness of the algorithm currently is that it's only about 50% sensitivity. So certainly some patients will be missed.
Right.
Part of this is again because of the arbitrary cutoff of 440 days.
Yeah.
So if somebody recurred at 441 days, my algorithm would say they're going to recur early.
Right.
But then upon testing on the reference standard outcome, it would say that it was a false positive.
Right.
So one of the ways I attempted to mitigate that weakness was to take the patients who were predicted to recur and do a standard Kaplan-Meier progression-free survival analysis.
Yep.
And that ended up being highly statistically significant with about an 1,000-day difference of recurrence time between the two groups and about twice as many people recurring in the group that were predicted to recur than the group that was not predicted to recur early.
Right. I presume you compared this against the reads in terms of whether they predicted the manual reads in terms of these studies, did they?
Correct. Yeah, so that's another excellent point. One of the ways that I attempted to purify my reference standard is I also excluded patients who had a local recurrence on a read, but then never had a regional recurrence, never had a distant recurrence, and never died of lung cancer, because you're 100% correct. All of my patients were followed with CT, not with PET CT.
Gotcha.
And so there's always a ton of post-radiation changes, pneumonitis, fibrosis, particularly in the first year.
Yep.
And so again, it was just a way to purify my reference standard. And by selecting people who clearly had a recurrence and then had some form of progression after that recurrence, the algorithm was much more likely to pick up the true date of recurrence rather than keeping in patients that may have recurred, might have been a false positive call.
Right.
So that was certainly one of the ways that I attempted to keep my reference standard as clean as possible.
Okay. So where do you see this heading? I mean...
Everywhere.
Okay. So is it going to replace radiologists or physicians? Is it going to just be a supplemental tool to them?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, certainly not anytime soon.
Right.
So there's a couple of reasons for this. My particular algorithm looks at one outcome in a highly defined patient population.
Right.
So
that's not the only questions asked when you do a scan, right?
For sure. And of course, the potential weakness then is it's answering one very defined question.
Right.
And physicians are faced with hundreds of questions for every
day. For example, is there inflammation?
True.
Is there, you know, has the patient got an infection?
Absolutely.
All those kind of things.
Yeah. But with respect to will it be augmenting human intelligence and physicians in the near future, no question.
Right.
Absolutely, it will. My prediction is that we'll have people who will be doing data entry as a full-time job for all of these oncology patients, who will be putting in all of the required features so that the algorithm can make a prediction.
Yep.
And I think it will be used, for example, the way that TNM is used right now. Why do we use TNM? Lots of reasons, but one of them is to convey a risk. And so machine learning is kind of like TNM, but instead of using three variables, it uses as many as you like, as many are predicted. Maybe it's 10, maybe it's 50, whatever is required to improve performance. And so that's really the new paradigm in that it's no longer going to be what can I process, how many variables can I weight to create an outcome. It's going to be, okay, the machine states that this person's at high risk for recurrence. What should we do now?
Right. So, I mean, part of that, I mean, a little bit, I mean, for decades now in cardiac, for example, we've had tools that assist the doctor in reporting a myocardial perfusion scan, you know, things like 3D, Cedar Sinai, and 40, Corridor 4DM, and so on.
Absolutely.
And we've had those for forever.
Absolutely.
Right. And they're useful. People do use those kind of things. The real question is, they're only as good as the data set that formed them.
Correct.
Is what you're doing only as good as the data set that you formed? And when technology changes, when the scan changes, when the scans get better or worse, is your data set useless?
So that's an excellent question. One of the benefits of my data set is that all of the patients have biopsy-proven lung cancer.
Right.
Sometimes patients will get treated with stereotactic body radiotherapy because they're not a surgical candidate and they might not even survive biopsy.
Yep.
And so those types of patients are excluded from my data set. You're absolutely right. One of the weaknesses of the data set is that it's still a fairly small data set from a machine learning standpoint. So 404 patients, with 60% of them in the training data set and 40% in the testing data set, from a machine learning standpoint, gives you small numbers. The particular model that I use, the extreme gradient boosting machine learning algorithm, cannot be used to extrapolate beyond my data set. So if there was a patient that had, you know, twice as much uptake in their tumor, if there was a linear association, perhaps with linear regression, you could still try to make some form of prediction, assuming that linearity maintained outside of the range that the patients were tested on. But with extreme gradient boosting, you really can only look at the data that was represented in your data set. And so as the data set gets bigger and more representative of the extremes rather than just the mean response, it will be better able to make predictions about extreme patients.
Right. I guess one of the things you've done, you haven't tried to take on the whole medical field in terms of predictions and so on, and you've stuck to dealing with something that you can measure in an image and in a
structure.
I mean, one example of try to take on the whole medical field, I don't think worked terribly well, was, for example, a Watson study that was done with MD Anderson, right? That didn't work out so well?
Fair enough. I mean, Watson's an evolving program.
Right.
So IBM is still deploying Watson in hospitals right now.
Yeah.
Watson certainly won at Jeopardy already, so.
Yeah.
the question is, could it eventually have enough data to make large, generic, sweeping predictions about large varieties of illness?
Yeah.
And the answer is absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Eventually it will. Is it going to be 5 years? Is it going to be 10 years? Maybe it'll be 20 years, 30 years even. People are notoriously poor at predicting beyond even 5 years. But what does a physician do, really? A physician takes and synthesizes large amount of data to come up with an outcome.
Right.
The only difference, I think, between a physician doing it and an algorithm doing it is, in an algorithm, you definitely have the data for every patient, and so every failure is going to get tracked.
Right.
Whereas if a physician were to make a mistake, currently the most likely response would be, yes, medicine's an imperfect science, everybody's doing their best.
People have got preferences, personal preferences, like you like this car rather than that car in some ways, you know.
Yes.
And you haven't, and those preferences, you don't know why you've got them, or you, or the person who told you didn't like them very much, or whatever it happens
to
be.
I like
whereas, them. whereas the computer is neutral in all of that topic.
In some ways. So as you mentioned previously, it's dependent on the data set.
Right.
So there are definitely examples of bias based on the documentation of the data,
yeah,
then getting incorporated into algorithms.
Right.
And it can be very subtle at times in that, so for example, perhaps a postal code might be associated with a lower socioeconomic status.
Gotcha.
So an algorithm.
Oh, okay, I'm familiar with that. Yeah, that, right.
So an algorithm might take postal code and actually introduce bias.
Right.
Based
like what happened in the UK when they tried to do the system and they thought that, and it turned out the postal code was a strong bias in terms of some of those outcomes, right?
Fair enough. Yeah, I'm not sure which specific study you're talking about, but
yeah,
that sounds very likely to me.
Yeah. So I guess you've taken this machine learning but applied it in a defined way to a defined study.
Correct.
And come up with a pretty robust outcome.
Yes.
Right? In the short term, do you think that's the place where learning should be used in medicine rather than taking too broad a slope? Because the truth is that in medicine, there's actually a lot less evidence than we think we have. Would that be fair enough? There's a lot of not so good studies with small numbers.
Yes.
And they often influence people's behavior.
I've forgotten his exact name, but there was a billionaire that used to work with Enron. Oh, I wish I could remember his name right now. And what he said is, when I make trades with Enron, I really have to know the answer.
Right.
Because hundreds of millions of dollars are on the line every time. And so he was basically saying that he was the purest form of scientist because it absolutely mattered what the truth was.
Right.
And so what he did is he took a lot of studies in psychology, and I think he called his project the Reproducibility Project.
Right.
And he started trying to recreate the studies using what he understood about scientific methodology to see whether those studies could be reproduced or not. And so you're absolutely right. In medicine, there can be studies with poor methodology, and there is definitely publication bias in that.
Yep.
Nobody wants to publish
the negative finding.
The negative finding, the boring finding.
Yep.
And so in turn, you end up with statistical fluctuations of only the positive studies and the other 50% not getting. And so when they do studies of gray literature, they realize a lot of things that we do might have actually just been based off of biases.
Right. And you know, well, the fMRI studies are a good example of that. There's been a lot of stuff about
that. I'd heard
that.
A bit about this, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd heard a little bit about that there was some bug in the algorithm.
That's
is
right.
That correct?
Right.
I'd heard a little bit about that.
Was missing, so over-representing stuff, but it had been done again and again and again, and people kind of believed it. And it's like recently we had a simple letter about the safety and efficacy of a drug that got quoted a million times and that followed through. But when someone actually went and did the research, they found that that wasn't true and it was applied in the wrong way about
sure.
whether something was safe or not in terms of opiate abuse, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Our letter was written to the editor saying people don't get addicted to opiates.
Oh, really?
And of course, that was taken as a gold truth, but of course we now know people do get addicted to opiates,
of course,
and more care should have been taken.
Sure.
But by using a computer as an independent arbiter, I think maybe we're going to end up with better and more robust data in some ways.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the beauties of machine learning compared to traditional inferential statistics is it seems like a lot of the inferential statistics try to exclude every type of bias, exclude collinearity,
yeah,
and heteroscedasticity. They try to exclude every potential source of bias to say this one variable is predictive of a patient outcome in
yeah.
the entire group. And so that's good. We definitely need that type of data. Absolutely. But the beauty of machine learning is then you can take those 10 or 20 studies that all in a specific area of learning state, this variable is predictive, and we have done such a robust way to try to prove that there's no bias, and then you can take all of those variables and put them into a machine learning algorithm to try to create a function that predicts an outcome of importance.
Right.
And so
then you can test that.
And then you can test that, and you can actually use it in a way where you are pretty confident that in this patient, right? Not the population on average, but in this patient with all of their specific
minutiae. So when we exclude women because we're worried about pregnancy risk, when we exclude children,
absolutely,
when we exclude people that have got atrial fibrillation or whatever it happens to be, or exclude this, exclude that, and of course you end up with a tiny segment of the population,
absolutely,
and then you're trying to infer a treatment for a tiny segment of the population.
That's 100% an issue, and You're 100% right that this is a way to try to take all of these individual predictors, and luckily most of the machine learning algorithms will tell you whether they remain predictive.
Right.
And one of the other benefits is it could be that there are collinear actions or interactions between different terms, which would have been excluded with linear regression.
Right.
But it could be that there is still some sort of synergistic effect or nonlinear effect between multiple variables, which can then be inferred with the algorithm rather than being tossed out as completely irrelevant because they don't fit the statistical model being used.
Okay. Do you think there's a possibility in your data set you've got one of those problems, though? For example, we know that people who live in poor neighborhoods have a higher reoccurrence of just about everything.
For sure.
Right? So do you think that your algorithm might be biased in terms of a richer area, or, and it's not going to work so well in a poorer area, for example?
Could be.
Right.
And that's the point of prospective proof,
yeah.
In that even if I do prospective proof, it will prove within the Ottawa hospital patient
right.
population
okay.
that it's predictive. So you're 100% right. It could be that they do something slightly different that was not captured in the model
yeah.
in a different jurisdiction or country.
Yeah.
And so the beauty again of machine learning, though, is if it turns out that there is a slight difference between the two patient groups in the way that they were treated, you can retrain the model at any point in time.
Right.
So you'd ask the question, maybe the old scanner doesn't work as well, and
yeah.
that could end up being an issue.
Yeah.
All you would do in that case is you would put in what the scanner was, what the parameters of the scan acquisition was,
right.
as its own independent model for every patient.
Yep.
I have that data currently, actually.
And then you can compare the two.
Exactly. And so it could be almost used as like a marketing. Oh, look, the patients who have a scan on a new type of scanner are much less likely
okay.
to recur.
We all need to buy a solid-state PET scanner, right?
We'll see, right?
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah. Well, that makes good sense.
So the model can always be retrained.
Yeah.
So the answer to your previous question of, do I have to throw all the old data out? No, because let's say worst-case scenario that we start testing for a certain genetic mutation over time.
Yeah.
Well, the 160 columns of data that I have on the original 500 or so patients still predict on their own.
Yeah.
So theoretically, you could still use all of those data points. And then this wouldn't be a good solution, but worst case scenario, you could acquire those data points on the new patient population and then just put the mutation in for that group
yeah.
and then just state directly that that data was missing in
yeah.
the old population. So you wouldn't get as good of a result on that particular variable of interest.
Yeah.
But the point is, these data sets do have the ability to evolve to changing medical practice. And, you know, really high uptake in a tumor 10 years ago was probably similarly predictive as to today. So that data doesn't become useless. You
yeah.
can still probably infer some of your function from that data.
Excellent. Well, that's really interesting. And where can we find out more about this?
So you can find out a lot about machine learning at various places, such as YouTube or publications. The most recent book that I read was actually Mastering Machine Learning
Right.
in R by Corey Leismeister
yep.
through PAC Publishing. That's a good way if you're interested in learning how to code. I did all of the coding in R. If you want to find out about my specific project, my name is Mark Bryanton, and I'll be publishing it shortly. This will probably be published on the Society of Nuclear
yep.
Medicine website as well. But realistically, you're just going to be hearing about machine learning, whether you try to find it or not.
Okay, excellent. All right. Thank you very much for helping us out with the podcast.
It's been a real pleasure.
Excellent. Thanks.
Thanks.